Hi, my name is Charlotte Armitage and this is Objects. Objects is a podcast that takes you on a journey through before, during and after care using the objects that mean the most to care experienced people. Who Cares Scotland is inviting you to come on this journey with us by listening to our podcast. Hello, I'm Charlotte Armitage and on this episode of Objects I'm speaking to Thomas Cartlin. Thomas is currently on secondment from his role as Implementation Lead at The Promise Scotland and is presently the lead for Moving On Change programme at Staff. He is a social worker and was awarded the University of Scotland's Amundsen Trophy when he graduated in 2014. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you for having us.
So before we get into the conversation about your objects that you've brought with you, please tell me a little bit about you and... anything that I kind of missed out in our introduction.
I don't think you missed much out. My name's Thomas. A normal person or normalish or whatever that means. I'm very proud to be a dad. And you touched on, I am a social worker and I've been involved in, worked in the sector for just over 10 years and trying to support and advocate for a better way of caring for those who require care and protection in their childhood. And that's because I am someone with experience of care, who had quite a poor experience of care, but also I'm someone who is a social worker who's practiced in social work in Scotland and actually want to, one, have a better way of how we support children and young people now, because I want to work in a system that enables us to do what we aspire to do, and that's get it right for those who need our help when they need our help.
Absolutely, and I think that's kind of one of the reasons that I wanted to speak to you on the objects is it's really interesting to see that sort of dynamic between a care experienced person yourself, knowing what it was like to be in the system and now being a social worker, supporting young people in the system. So I'm really glad that you were quite happy to come along. Before we get into the conversation, as I said before, I would like to know a little bit about your process of finding your objects and how it was for you. Was it an easy process for you?
Yeah, so maybe just before we get that one, thank you. I'm more than willing to be here, but I did spend some time thinking about it because there is something, there has been great benefit at times for me been owning my care identity, working as a professional in this sector. But at other times there's been a real challenge, which has prompted pity, and pity is not empowering. For me, it's actually a way of oppressing and othering others. There's been times where I've been treated like a trinket in the workplace, where actually I've been able to do the work that I've been doing by able to demonstrate competence. Does that make sense? I've not got those jobs because of my care experience. So there was a lot of thought went into whether or not to accept the opportunity because, at times there's just been a consequence, not necessarily a positive consequence of people seeing you through those lenses. Mm-hmm. And at times can be blinded by what their perception is of care experience. And actually, I think that's something that what I will continue and others will continue to navigate when the context of care is not right, but also society's understanding of who we are as individuals, mm-hmm. but also who we are as a community is better understood. I think that will continue to be a challenge. So thank you for having us. I'm happy to be here, but I did wonder what the impact might be about taking part. But I think it's really important that when you do have lived experience of care that and you're kind of in a better place that you can demonstrate that you can be hopeful. The stats that the system has spoke about, people like me and you and others for decades and generations, normally actually to service the system needs to gain resource is part of the reason why we actually have negative experiences at times. Does
Absolutely.
That make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
And I hope if by just taking part that I show you can have some of those difficult experiences, but you can go on and hopefully begin to live a life on your own terms.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that really resonates with me. I've had this conversation with you before, so it's really great that you've brought it to the table and I'm glad it's now going to be out there for other people to understand. Going back to the first conversation. Sorry,
So in relation to the objects, you asked how difficult or easy or whatever the process was to find it. For me, it was a little bit challenging because the objects have to be one before care, one during and one after, and I've not necessarily had a care experience that started at one point. There was social work involvement in my family's life long before I was in care, and actually the vast, because of my care journey and the number of moves, I've not really got anything from before, and I didn't really know what to use for during, and was curious to figure out how I could find, meet that challenge of having three objects. But I've came today with three objects that hopefully will enable us to have a decent conversation, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, okay. Well, that sounds like probably the right time to get stuck into it then. Could you tell me what your first object is and that represents before care for you?
So I was in and out of care from birth, but the object I have for my first one that hopefully represents some of what could be before care or more time with my family is actually a picture that I didn't get till I was 26, and it's the first time I ever seen a baby picture of me and my twin brother, and the person in the picture that's holding us is my Aunt Heather. And before my adoption broke down, I actually had no memories of Aunt Heather, so I would never, if I'd seen this picture without actually going back to connect with my real family, I would never have met Aunt Heather before Aunt Heather died, so I would never have known who it was that was holding us. And the person next to her in that picture that's holding us is my cousin Janelle, and I've met Janelle and have a really good close relationship with Janelle's children, who are closer to my age because Janelle's a wee bit older than me, if she wouldn't mind me saying. And for me, it was phenomenal to be able to get the picture at the age of 26 because I'd never seen it. But it's also a wee bit difficult because no one can tell me what one's me and what one's my brother, and we're not identical twins, we're just we're twins. And for me, the reason why it's nice to have a baby photo is because actually numerous times throughout my life, people have asked, so at school, people used to ask, can you bring in baby pictures? And I wouldn't have any, and it would be a way of exposing, I don't think ever intentionally, but it was a way of it being very clear that I was different to other people in my school and in my class. And there was a feeling of real shame at times about that. And also I've seen it as a professional in the sector, actually organisations I've worked with or worked alongside holding baby photo competitions to raise money for comic relief and children in need. And actually I think for me that's a demonstration at times where people can be allies to those with experience of care and actually be seeking every single part of their working day to be doing good by those they seek to serve, which is normally care experienced people in that sense, but not necessarily having a true understanding of what it's like to be care experienced, because for me that's a demonstration when those entities have done that of them actually not being aware about what the impact of that
for
is
sure. It's like an unconscious bias, isn't it?
Yeah
absolutely.
It's and it's because actually it's just a the way at times that I will continue as a man to be made aware of how I sometimes am ignorant as a man about the issues that women go through or my daughter's going to experience. For me, it's an example of that. It's not necessarily intended malice, but it's a demonstration of the ignorance. And actually, in general society, I'm not too bothered about that. Actually, I think that shows us sometimes we've got work to do. Mm-hmm. But actually, I do have huge frustrations at times where those who seek to be custodians of the care system or David Attenboroughs of people like me are not able to demonstrate a level of insight that I think actually is required if you're going to be leaders within the sector that seeks to care and respond to children and families in crisis.
Absolutely. So kind of coming back to the photo, you said yourself in your introduction that you're a father. How it must be quite interesting looking at this photo now, knowing that you've got your own little girl and what that must have been like, you know, making that point of making sure that you had baby photos of your little girl. How was that for you?
Oh, I can't tell you how lucky I feel, like in an immeasurable sense, about being Mirren's dad. She's phenomenal. She's like the best, she's the best thing that's ever happened to us, and I feel so fortunate to be a dad. I think I genuinely try every single day since I found out that she was coming to try and be the best dad I possibly can. There's definitely times where I've got that right, and I'm sure Mirren will tell me when she does give me feedback quite often. But I believe that me and our mum and I aren't together, but despite that, I think me and her mum do our very, very best every single day to try and make sure that she has and experience that will be very different to the one that me and our mum had growing up. And I have things from when she's been first here and now she's four, and I feel like I'm bad at hoarding things that is probably relevant to her, but I hope maybe one day that she'll appreciate that I've kept. So even when we went on holiday to Spain there, I kept like her boarding pass. I've kept wee things that we went to the cinema. They don't give out tickets anymore because we use the phone, but I just keep things so that hopefully she knows that when she's older that there's reminders there of who she once was, because she'll grow and develop. Does that make sense?
For sure.
I think becoming a parent, I think as a social worker, it's made me definitely think about some of the things I said as a social worker, and maybe would not say some of those things again. As someone with an experience of care, though, I think it's made me, which surprised me, less forgiving to my own parents and also to those who were charged with their care that did me and my brothers and sisters real harm at times.
Yeah.
And I try and hope for tomorrow rather than seeking blame for yesterday. And my hope would be that I can continue to try and do my very best at being a better person, mm-hmm. so that I can be hopefully the best dad that I possibly can be, and hopefully a good enough dad that Mirren deserves. I can feel emotional saying that, but it's just because she's like phenomenal. She's like my girl is phenomenal. I've never experienced a love for someone like that before in my life, but I've never experienced a love from someone else like the Mirren provides. It's a phenomenal experience, but also at times a phenomenal challenge. So I don't think I'll ever get my L plates off. And she's four and I still can't do a plate despite me trying many times watching YouTube videos about how to do that.
I think that definitely comes. I've got a big brother that's got two little girls. My niece is seven and he's still trying to figure all that out. So you'll get there. But
Hopefully.
Yeah, that love that you described, you can really feel it just in this conversation. And I wanted to say that because I think it's important for you to know that. You kind of touched upon a little bit about the people that cared for you when we were during care. So that might be a good transition into your next object, which represents during care for you. So can you tell us a little bit about your second object?
So my second object, I couldn't necessarily find. So my second object is two pictures just now, and one of them is of a Mr. Blobby can and one of them is a Coke can, but they're not, the Coke can isn't, the reason why I couldn't find one today was because actually they're wee 150ml cans, and when I was around the age of seven, I was told that me and some of my siblings, not all of us, were going to go and be adopted, and in some ways there was a huge sense of loss about that, but also there was some real almost manic excitement, because the narrative around our adoption was so Disney-esque. We were continually reminded that we were very fortunate that people had picked us because we weren't babies, and that was rare, that people wanted to take people of our age. We were continually reminded that although it was going to be difficult not getting to see some of our brothers and sisters or not live with them, that we were really fortunate that people wanted to take me and Kevin as twins, but also my younger sister who we weren't staying with at the time. And that enabled me to really think what was going to come would be much better than what had been before. And also my biological family were part of what I thought was our identity, was their faith in the Catholic religion, and also the placement that I stayed with before the adoptive family were very Church of Scotland religious. So the reason why I'm mentioning that is because literally at times I'd prayed for a mum and dad. I'd prayed for things to be much better for me, my brothers and sisters. And that's because, like, we had memories at times of being taken into social work departments and just left by mum or dad. But also experiences of going to school and people not coming to sports days or things that other people had people going to. Also in our foster placements that we'd been in, yeah, it was furnished much nicer than the places that my mum and dad had stayed, and it was more middle class, but at times experienced a real othering, so none of the stuff in those houses were ours. It was it was branded as the family's. It was the family's bed. At times in the foster placement I went to before my adoptive family, the reason my coke and brandy stuff was seen as so different was because the family got branded stuff and we would get, at the time it was Safeway Savers kind of stuff. So when we went to my adoptive family, I just remember going to visit and I can still smell the pine furniture. I can smell the newness of the paint. We were going to get allegedly a family that were always going to be there. We were getting a life of what felt like a very picturesque, dreamy family situation. And actually that was one of the first times then we began to experience things like we had things that could be ours. And I remember at times being encouraged to like want toys, but because of a lot of my previous experiences had been looking after either my mum or monitoring or looking after siblings, I'd not necessarily been encouraged to play in that way. I found that really strange. So I remember asking and getting action in, but they used to just sit there because I didn't play with them. Like, sure, I didn't have those experiences. But the reason why I picked these objects is because I do remember then getting to go to places that we'd never been before. And it didn't feel like people like me got to go, which was, these were literally bought out of Woolworths and they were just wee mini cans of juice. And I couldn't believe that we were allowed to go in the shop, but we were allowed to get them and then we were allowed to have them. And at one point, my adoptive family had spoken to social work at the time, but I remember being asked to come up the stairs and they asked why in the chest of drawers, the pine chest of drawers, there was like drawers for clothes and then there was like a drawer for like just your stuff. And they'd asked me why I'd been keeping rubbish in the drawer. And what I'd been keeping in the drawer was these empty cans. And then with the Mr. Blobby one, there was also, I remember, they'd got Mr. Blobby napkins and they'd used that at lunch at point. And the reason why I'd kept them was because it felt surreal that we were getting these things that were probably just a given. But I worried that, like, just like at times things felt good at home with my biological mum and dad, and eventually it would disintegrate and things would happen, it wouldn't be there. I put them and wanted to keep them in case I was going to get sent away again, and at least I would have something to take. And also something to evidence that I'd had there was a more positive period.
Yeah, for sure.
It was more aligned to other people in my school's reality or other children's reality. Does that make sense?
And absolutely.
At that point, I remember we'd had experience, and that's the first time, round about that point was the first time maybe experiencing sort of a discrimination about, or not discrimination, I think sometimes sounds too strong a word for me, but I don't know, a difference or treated different because of my experience of care. So I remember at that point, initially, people being very accepting or they just realised who we were, but when we moved school, people saying things like, "Is your sister Annie?" And I'm one of seven children from the same mum and dad. And I was like, "No, my sister's not Annie." And I'd be like, "How?" And what someone was like, "Because their mum and dad didn't want them either."
Okay.
And it's, so at that point, probably around about the age of seven, had a lot of things going on and was really, really hopeful that the narrative of what had been told about our adoptive experience was going to be that. And I think that then began a journey of really trying to assimilate into a family that I wasn't in now through fault of birth. I was in for because other adults had told me that that's where I should be. And just because these people had said they would take us, there was some sort of thinking that everything should just slot in and fit perfectly forever. And I look back on that and think that was naive and the extreme of quite a lot of people. That's the objects.
The objects. It strikes me that you talked about difference, but and feel free to say that this is not the case. This is just my observation that these objects kind of somewhat represent a bit of control as well. A lot of what you've just described was completely out of your control because you were seven. But keeping these objects close to you at that time was one form of control that you had in your own life. Do you understand what I'm trying to kind of say?
I think so, but I don't know. Like, I really don't know. For me, it was about just being able to keep hold of something. Like, because I didn't. So the foster placement I'd been before then, at one point there was five of us in a double room. So five children being in a double room. Now we're talking, as a social worker, what I talk to people about was trying to have residential homes and children's homes for children and young people that are much smaller than the ones that my brothers and sisters stayed in. They're not like the Balloch & Rane and the Jailsland, which were huge. We now only look after children and young people in residential homes and placements during about five or six bedded units. Mm-hmm. That's our aspiration. So before I moved to my dog placement, there was five of us in a double room.
Yeah.
So then there you wouldn't even have had your own stuff. Everything was the families, and then everything in that room was up for grabs for anybody.
Sure.
So I think for me it was the first time, like, if I was going to get papped away, I couldn't put the smell of the pine in something and take it with me.
Absolutely.
I couldn't take the nice new carpet. I couldn't take my mum and dad. Mm. And the toys thing and that were material things. So being adopted, I experienced a material difference that I'd never experienced before. Does that make sense? At times there was real experiences of real material privilege, but I wasn't putting them in a drawer to take with me. Mm-hmm. I was taking these things because they felt like a validation. Because there were simple things that people were kind of used to, and it felt like we were now deserving of those things.
Absolutely.
And if I was to get taken away again, then I was taking them to prove we'd actually used to get these, have some of this. And it's not about the material stuff, it was more about not being treated and responded to in constant charity and pity in a way that than others do, so you don't get given the same. Like, you're not seen as the same, you're not treated as equal. Like, the reason why, even as a care experienced adult, I really struggle with people's pity of care experienced people, particularly if they're adults, is because that pity then prevents people being able to achieve social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, if you pity someone, you don't think that they're going to live in the same house as you. Mm-hmm. You don't think that you're going to work alongside them in the same job.
That's it.
And actually, people like me, just because we've been born into situations that have required the state to intervene to safeguard our lives, it's been through no fault of our own. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And actually, I don't want someone's pity. I don't want someone's handout. For the last 10 years, when I've been very lucky to be working with people like myself across these islands and beyond, and in Australia and Holland and whatever else, I have never heard any care experienced young person or adult ask for a handout. I've heard them asking for a hand up.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I've went on and rambled a wee bit there. Sorry, Charlotte.
No, absolutely not. This is the perfect space to have these conversations.
For me, it was just about being able to have something to take. I didn't have anything in it. I now, as an adult, my biological parents are dead. I do have something of my dad's from before he passed. But it's like it's an old jacket, and it's a wee trinket box that he had for smoking and stuff like that. And my mum's passed, and I've got a wee thing of hers. And they didn't necessarily have anything of material wealth, but for my appreciation of the things I've got of them wasn't anything about wanting something of material value. It was something of emotional significance, for want of a better phrase, something that connected me to them. Does that make sense?
And I suppose that's kind of the beauty of what objects is about, is it's not about the worth in terms of, like you say, material worth or like financial worth of an object. It's the stories and connections that these objects have and host for us, and that sentimental value. That's kind of the reason that we came up with the whole sort of idea of objects is, and actually, interestingly, speaking to you just now, it's not just the objects that you brought with you today. There's various objects that people talk about throughout the podcast in their lives that also have that significant sentimental value.
Wow.
So I think that's just a really powerful outlet, to be honest.
So I'm really pleased now that I don't have a sentimental attachment now to cans of ginger. So that's how I don't actually have them physically here with us anymore. And I would say the probably the introduction to them and Bowers has led to me being a frequent drinker of, it used to be Iron Brew, if I'm honest with you. So as a social worker, people would identify me as the social worker that walked about with an Iron Brew and a straw. They've got rid of straws now, so like I don't know what that's doing at my teeth. But then Iron Brew get rid of the stuff that was in it that was doing what it was doing to me. So I'm constantly drinking them now. And actually, I'm very fortunate now that I live quite a good life where actually they're not, that's not something that would seem like a treat for me. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I am very proud though that my 4-year-old girl, we were former colleagues, I'm saying that because I'm talking what feels like a wee bit of work setting. Claudia, that I used to work with at Ocare Scotland, we were at her house a good while ago in the summer, and Midden was offered fizzy juice there, and Midden on her road back turned around and said, no, sorry, I'm not allowed that. That's what it makes me feel, although I am drinking far too much of carbonated juices, Midden's having greater foresight than me that's not very healthy or good for us.
Yeah, well, there you go, it's working. That kind of actually feels like a good segue into where you are now and talking about aftercare, which is actually quite a big chunk of people's lives. It's not just like the here and now, but, you know. So how would you like to discuss this? Would you want to start with your object, or do you want to kind of go in the back of the conversation we were just having?
I don't know. So the way that the legislation would state that I left care on the 17th of March 1999, because that's when my adoption was finalised, and it's St Patrick's Day. I'll remember it for the rest of my I'll remember that for the rest of my life. And that then has that legal definition had then quite detrimental impacts for me and my twin at one point. So unfortunately the adoption went through years of real quite challenges of things that were just a bit difficult, I think, for everybody involved. And then just before my 16th birthday, the adoption disintegrated. So, and part of that was, I think as well, because when the adoption was finalised when I was 9, as I said earlier, and I'm 1 of 7. I had 9 years of knowing who my mum was. I had 9 years of knowing who my family were. I had 9 years of knowing my brothers and sisters. And I was always promised that I would get to see my brothers and sisters who weren't getting adopted with us. And that didn't happen. It just stopped abruptly with no explanation. Mm-hmm. And no even support to get over what I would say was a feeling of bereavement. Just as our adoption was being finalised, my mum had been in the jail for a wee while, so we used to go to Court and Vale to see her. Then I had to go and say goodbye to her. And I think that's the most difficult thing, actually. One of the most difficult things I've experienced in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was away, and we just get sent in a room, but not much bigger than this.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like the Fisher Price house in the corner, and I just sat next to my mum like the whole time. And waited to say goodbye. And I think it's naive. It was extremely naive for a lot of the people around us not to think that the children would need some support with that. And actually, I think the narrative around adoption meant that when I was adopted, my name changed legally.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you're part of another family. And I think I tried my best to assimilate to that family, but also struggled with not being able to be honest with with that family I missed and had an emotional connection and worry at times about my family that were my family. Does that make sense? So it was when my birthday, we were about, I would look for my mum.
Yeah.
And then she would never come. Anyway, so the adoption broke down when I was just coming up for 16, and my wee sister unfortunately ended up back in care, and at one point was secured because of some of the trauma she'd experienced before and during that adoptive placement. My brother and I were just on the cusp of our 16th birthday, and we were told that we didn't have then a care leaver status because we'd been adopted. And I'm sighing there as I say, because I still feel that was unjust. And that meant that actually we did not have anywhere to turn. I presented as homeless on a couple of occasions. I sofa surfed and did whatever I had to do for a good while. But so the object that then I've brought is at the age of 16, I'd done paper rounds. I'd worked in a wee shop in the place that I grew up. I'd worked in an office at some point, but I went and got a job when I was 16 in Burger King that I thought was going to be for Christmas. And actually, I was there for years. Like, I was there for the age of 17 till just... Actually, I never left there, although I got offered jobs. Like, I worked for Alzheimer's Scotland when I was at uni, but Burger King felt so secure, so I never left. And I left Alzheimer's Scotland, stayed with Burger King. And I didn't leave Burger King until I got my advocacy job at Who Cares Scotland in 2013. But when I was 17 and I was working in Burger King, I'd been told to leave school, not because they didn't think I was clever, but they didn't really want me there. And I was told basically pick a college course and go. So while I was in Burger King, I was doing an ANC hire just at that point, doing social care, because I'd wanted to be a social worker since I was 14. But anyway, at that point, Burger King, then I had a phenomenal restaurant manager, a woman called Kay McLean, and I've thanked her a couple of times. I've seen her over the years, but she looks at me as if I've got nothing to be thankful for, and she doesn't...
You can take a moment if you want.
I just don't think she knows that I've been able to convey. Sorry, I just don't think I've been able to convey to her how thankful I am. So at the age, so at 16, was just working in Burger King Limited, was quite often in the drive-thru, but at times was a gallus, mouthy 16-year-old. So the reason why I'm saying that bit is then I couldn't believe at times the faith that Kay showed in me. So Burger King became the first place that actually I wasn't othered and nobody cared that I was Kay experienced. You didn't need to hide it, you didn't need to sanitise yourself for MD. But even if they did find out, like, sure, nobody cared. And actually... it was the first place that I experienced an equity where equal opportunities meant equal responsibility. And if you worked and you grafted, you kind of got the reward for that. And at 17, I was one of the youngest, I believe, in the company to be offered to start on my management training course. And that I left college at the time and went full time, thought I was going to end up having enough money to sustain my life and begin to begin to have agency and begin to be able to live my life on my terms and hopefully have a pathway away from destitution and the constant fear of experiencing destitution again. So the folder that sits in front of me is my basic management training workbook, and I if you look through it, it's just about how to manage shifts and bucket, how to just become a manager basically. And the reason why I hold on is because I don't have much stuff from at all, growing up at all, or even, it's not really until my early 20s things became a wee bit more secure and settled that I've been able to now hold on to things a bit better. But I'll always hold on to this because Burger King was the place that enabled me to see that I could begin to carve out my own path. It enabled me to have a distance from the system that had done me harm at times and also hadn't done right by us at times. So the foster placement before my adoptive placement in 2013, I was required to attend court. And it was not my view at the time, because at the time I thought these people were lovely and I kept on saying thank you even when I was in court giving evidence, but they abused me and other children in their care. And actually I wondered if I hadn't got the job in Burger King, would I ever have been able to get on a path that actually I'm really quite fortunate when I'm in life now. I don't know if I hadn't been able to get away from the system, if the system would have othered me that much, that might have been incredibly difficult. And when I was getting a wee bit lost for words, obviously, or because I was a bit emotional earlier when I was speaking about Kay, that woman was utterly phenomenal for me, because she gave me an opportunity and I tried to make the best of that opportunity and I can continue to try and demonstrate I was appreciative of that opportunity by working as hard as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And that opportunity really provided me chances to better regulate myself, to actually better get alongside people, to actually mm-hmm. understand the world, not just the world of institutionalised. Because I think when you're care experience, I think sometimes there can be a risk of us becoming somewhat institutionalised. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you're not care experience, I don't know if you'll get what I'm meaning there, but I do believe there was I was slightly institutionalised coming away from mm-hmm. care, and it opened my eyes to a wider world. It also then enabled me to have some of the best friendships I've ever had in my life. It's where I met my first love, her family were utterly phenomenal to me, and when we first got together after a while, I was like, you love me, I love you, and here they've got a dental plan, what, have a family? And she was like, no, not Burger King wages, Thomas, and you've always wanted to go to uni, and why would you not go to uni? And I was like, because that's not for people like me. Mm. And her and her family and colleagues in Burger King encouraged me to go and take a punt and go and figure out a way of seeing if it was possible to become a social worker. And I did, and I went to Skills Development Scotland, it was Career Scotland at Skills Development Scotland now, sorry. It was Career Scotland, and I remember going in and asking them if they could give me some advice about how I could get from being a manager of Burger King to becoming a social worker. And the woman kept on speaking to me at the time about if I wanted to become a social carer, and maybe I should think about going and just trying to see about doing an HNC. And eventually I was very clear, no, with the greatest respect, I don't want to become a social carer, I want to be a social worker. And then when she went and seen my results for my standard grades, I never did my highest when I was at school, I went and seen my results for my standard grades, and seen at 14 when I went and seen the careers advisor, I said I want to be a social worker. She then helped me work out a pathway for that, and I did a year at college doing my highest, and then I went on to uni, and then I found 2 Care Scotland, and mm-hmm. I've then went on to have some phenomenal career and life opportunities since then. But the reason why, again, Burger King is so fond, I have such fondness for it, is when I was doing my hires at college, I could register for college, but I needed to have proof of household income to be able to get any financial support, and my living situation was meaning that I was still technically homeless, mm-hmm. And I couldn't get any of the financial support. So to do college and do the hires I was doing, so it was full-time at college, I then worked full-time, and Burger King gave me the flexibility to still have development opportunities so that if my thing I was on didn't work out, then I could still fall back and I wouldn't be too at disadvantage compared to my peers who'd became managers around about the same time as me. And they also then provided me the opportunity to be able to continue to fund my life and meet my basic needs so that then I could go on at university and then eventually leave. So I'm unbelievably thankful, not just to Kay mm-hmm. McLean, who initially seen beyond some of my prickly behaviour, I would say, but a number of people there that showed real good faith, that stood alongside me when at times I felt there was nobody, and also began to enable me to see my worth, that I actually can become quite a successful, positive yeah. contributor to society.
Absolutely.
And that's when I said earlier on, when I've never heard a care experienced person asking for a hand up or a handout. A handout, it's always a hand up. I really think that Burger King provided me that opportunity to have someone reach out and provide a hand, and hopefully they would say that I did that opportunity justice. And really mm-hmm. without me completing this book, me getting that opportunity, I'm not necessarily sure where I'd be. And I'm 1 of 7. And I am more than aware from my own family circumstances and also some of my cousins and my cousin's children who are care experienced, that it's not the easy, it's not easy necessarily, or a straight path for us to achieve similar outcomes that society hopes that all citizens of Scotland achieve. And I'm not here or in the position that I'm in through anything else, I believe, other than real luck and opportunity. And I do the work that I do just now because I really hope that actually more and more people can actually get to securing a happy and safe adulthood, not through choice or luck, but because actually that's to just be a given, and I think in childhood. Does that make sense? That's
absolutely
what I hope to provide for Mirren, and that's what I really believe that. That's what I believe that when I got to stand and hear the First Minister announce a written branch review of care back in October 2016, I was overwhelmed. For me, it was, and that's why I'm so thankful and so fond of Who Cares Scotland, because actually Who Cares Scotland enabled somebody like me. So during, after in going to uni, I'd almost sanitised myself. I honestly could have came across quite middle class and had narratives for everything so that no one ever knew that I was care experienced. Getting to being employed at Who Cares Scotland and then getting the phenomenal chance to be alongside a woman called Carly and setting up a policy function was amazing. But it was also like, it was dreamy at times. What we were being asked, myself and Carly, to do at times was find a way of actually getting Scotland to respond in a much better way. In a way that I always have believed that if you can't rely on your parents, you should be able to rely on your community and your nation. And when I had seen the former First Minister stand on a stage and say that actually that she was committing to a written branch review of care to ensure that more people with experience of care had access to equity and social justice, for me, that was the beginning of a demonstration of a nation beginning to work towards delivering on that aspiration. If you can't rely on your parents and we as a nation decide to intervene and do something to you in childhood, then what we're going to do is make sure that you can rely on us to be able to secure that safe and happy adulthood. And I think that's something as a nation we should be incredibly proud of, that actually that we started that journey and we've embarked on that journey, not because our services were inspected by the custodians or the system has been inadequate. We have embarked on that journey in Scotland because care experienced people found their voice collectively, amplified their voice and used it to secure a commitment to change. And now actually we're moving away. I think we're now in Scotland in 2023 away from having to lobby so hard for change or just hear a rhetoric of change. And I'm very, very fortunate now that I get to be involved in trying to lead in the delivery of the vision that Scotland now has in relation to what we now term as keeping the promise to children and families in Scotland. And that's, I think we should never lose sight of the fact that back in 2014 when me and Carly started doing some of that work, I never felt possible, but it has been possible. Does that make sense?
And yeah, for sure.
It's been possible to a community of care experienced people being supported and enabled to begin to speak the truth, and not the truth as in the way that, or framed in the way that the David Attenboroughs of people like us have sought to speak of us before, speak our own truth. And I do really do believe that we're in a much better position than what we once were, or what we were when I left care. Because although much of the environment of care has improved since the 90s, some of the content or context in which children find themselves hasn't improved enough. But we're now in a journey that I'd really believe that will disrupt the altruism that's been within the so-called care system for decades and actually begin to deliver a more caring response to children and families in need, but also deliver a much better place and in environment to work in for people like me, people like social workers who will spend a vast majority of our careers trying to do the best we possibly can for those we seek to serve. And the imperfect context of care, the consequences of that has been borne far too often and by the majority of situations by those with the least resource, so i.e. those with lived experience of care. But also, there has been consequences for the imperfect context of care on the workforce. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we should just be mindful of that. One of the things we're leading on just now, or you spoke of me being seconded to staff, is on a new change programme, a MOOC called Moving On Change Programme, that's seeking to accelerate the pace of change for the promise being delivered for those moving on from care. And actually, we know that at times those who move on from care are not given access to the social justice in which they deserve. Mm-hmm. And I feel really fortunate and privileged to be able to lead on that work. And I hope that some people who may listen to this podcast might be willing to sign up and get involved, because actually one of the phases that we are launching at the beginning of National Care Experience Week is the 100 Days of Listening, and we are really looking to engage with care experience people and those of the workforce to better understand how can we deliver upon the aspiration and vision that we're all working towards. And I really, really would be willing to try and listen and get alongside everybody and anybody who'd wish to get involved.
That's really an amazing point to kind of wrap up your aftercare journey. The final question I want to leave on is in the sort of similar vein as to what you just said, speaking to everybody and anyone. This is the second series of Objects. We've had 6 guests before, and we hope in the future we'll have more guests coming on to Objects to tell our truth and our way, as you said, speaking there. So do you have any advice for anyone that would potentially be thinking about coming on to Objects? You know, you talked about a lot of your own personal experience there. What advice do you have anyone that might be considering coming and sitting down as a guest of Objects?
I don't know. Like, at times I can feel a wee bit overwhelmed when I've been asked for people for advice, things that I think I'm not clever and important enough or got the knowledge to provide that advice. So maybe I would try and provide some reflections. I think I did spend some real time considering whether or not this was something that I wanted to do. I think when we play it back, I'll probably be a little bit embarrassed that at times I found it slightly emotional, but that the emotion is real, because actually everyone's impacted by their life journey, and that my life journey will impact on me. Mm-hmm. There is a risk at times if you own the fact that you're impacted by your care experience, that you increase the risk of pathologization of others on you and on your community. I think sometimes there's just a risk to that. So for me, what I would say is, my reflection would be, I think actually if people offer or ask you to get involved in something, be making sure that that's something that you spend some time about and make an informed choice. Are you wanting to say yes because you want to do it, or you want to say yes because you're trying to please others around you? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And also, like I said, since the age of 14 that I wanted to be a social worker, I never ever thought I was going to get involved in some of the stuff that we've been able to do in mm-hmm. Scotland. I just thought I was going to be the children and family social worker that I was for mm-hmm. a while in local authority practice. And the reason why I'm saying that is because at times I think it's utter nonsense when I have heard people who have experienced social injustice or had a really poor experience of care, that there seems to be an almost uniform encouragement then to say, do you know what would be cathartic for you? Come and get involved in changing the system. Mm. And actually, I don't believe that that is cathartic. I don't make it funny. I've been really privileged to be involved in actually leading quite tangible change, like mm-hmm. pure, like in Scotland and elsewhere. It doesn't make the experiences that I've had any better. And I think mm-hmm. I would ask those who support care experience people to stop uttering that nonsense. Mm-hmm. But at times, actually, I found it really empowering by being able to demonstrate a greater acceptance of who I am, who my family are, who my community are. Mm-hmm. And I found that empowering. So what I'm trying to say is, I think for anybody that's getting involved in not just the podcast, getting involved in actually some of the owning your care identity in a way that's kind of exposing, or getting involved in the campaign and the delivery of change, take some time to think whether that's something you want to do. Because mm-hmm. the vast majority of good experience of the education system in Scotland. Mm-hmm. I very rarely hear people who are disillusioned by the education system being mm-hmm. asked to, why don't you go and think about becoming, mm-hmm. or why don't we all become teachers? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And actually, for some people, that is the right thing. I'm not saying it's one way or another, but I think sometimes we have an overgeneralization. Mm-hmm. We're all individual. We are all part of a bigger community, mm-hmm. but we're not all the same. We're individuals. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I would say, just have take some time to think about it. And I think the greatest reflection I would give is the best thing for me is actually has been able to find acceptance in myself.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see in the management folder there, it says Thomas, and it's got a different second name to the one I have now. And that's because when I was adopted, my second name was changed. When Mirren was going to be born, I spent some time thinking about what name is Mirren going to have. And me and her mum spoke at length whether or not it would be from her mum's side or it would be from my side. And when we both came to a decision that it would be from my side, I then decided to go and change my name back. And my name's now the same as when I was born, Thomas Carrollton, and that's the second name that my amazing wee girl has. And for me, that's a demonstration of that acceptance. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
That change of my name back, though, had to be done in the same way that if I want to call myself Luke Skywalker.
Mm.
And actually, when my biological mum died a couple of years ago, the reality of that change in legal terms about who I was surfaced again, because the adoption severed all legal ties to my biological mum and her ties to us. So that actually meant that when our small, very, very small and modest estate was being divvied up, my mum didn't have a will. It went to my siblings that weren't adopted. And I'm saying that not because of the sense of frustration and the hurt, and that wasn't about the material thing. It was the remembrance that the state did something
mm-hmm.
that will have a lifelong impact on me forever, and at times will continue to surface. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on Objects and sharing all of that with us. It was a really great episode.